We are yet we're at the point of Archbishop Brennan's report. We are yet and if I might just indicate the procedure which we will use, Archbishop Brennan is giving really what amounts to a substantive report of the work of a committee in progress. It is not a committee, obviously, which has finished its work. Therefore, the committee does not intend to engage in dialogue on its work. It's merely presenting what it proposes to do. After Archbishop Brennan has made his presentation, then bishops who may wish to speak, in a sense, to the committee, but not, I guess, engage in debate with the committee, because the committee is issuing a proposal. But bishops who would wish to speak to the issue, speak to the committee, may feel perfectly free to the committee is issuing a proposal. But bishops who would wish to...
Thank you, Archbishop Roach. I appreciate very much the opportunity to report the progress of the work of our committee, the Ad Hoc Committee on War and Peace. There is abroad in the church today an intense concern about the nuclear arms race and the danger it poses for ourselves and others. In response to that concern, the leadership of our conference judged it necessary to set aside time for an oral report on the work of the Ad Hoc Committee on War and Peace. As chairman of that committee, I wish to share with you some perspectives on its work and to receive your counsel and your views on this most urgent moral question. In these remarks, I will review the committee's origin, indicate the framework of Catholic teaching within which we will function, and examine some of the questions and issues we face. First, the committee's origin and composition. The committee had its origin in a resolution of the 1980 General Meeting of NCCB. After an extended exchange among the bishops on a variety of questions regarding the moral and pastoral challenge posed by modern warfare, we voted to pursue a study which would review the NCCB position thus far and would set a direction for the Episcopal Conference in the future. In light of this resolution, Archbishop Roach asked me to chair the committee. Bishops George Fulcher, Thomas Gumbelson, John O'Connor, and Daniel Riley have agreed to serve with me. I wish the committee will be staffed and assisted by Mr. Edward Doherty and Father Brian Hare of USCC. They in turn will be assisted by Professor Bruce Russett of Yale University. Dr. Russett is a professor of political science. He is presently the editor of the Journal of Conflict Resolution, one of the leading peace research journals in the United States. He brings exceptional qualifications to this task. The committee is also privileged to have the assistance of Sister Juliana Casey of the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, and Father Richard Warner, the Congregation of the Holy Cross. Sister Juliana and Father Warner represent the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and the Conference of Major Superiors of Men. Our committee did not become operative until late spring. We have had two meetings and have drawn up a roster of consultants spanning the field of biblical studies and moral theology, as well as foreign, defense, and strategic policy. We also intend to listen to the voices of interested Catholic groups and individuals. We will receive the views of these various witnesses in our deliberations. Our report to the bishops which we will propose for consideration as a pastoral letter of the NCCB, will be ready for the 1982 November meeting. Second, the framework of Catholic teaching. As bishops doing a moral religious analysis of contemporary warfare within the tradition of Catholic moral teaching, we do not start from scratch. As religious leaders in a nation which possesses an awesome arsenal of destructive power, we are also heirs of a body of moral teaching from the Universal Church. And we have ourselves contributed to that teaching by our previous statements on war and peace. In addition, there is available to us a significant corpus of theological commentary, as well as several contributions from individual bishops in our conference over the past several years. Within the past few months, a substantial number of bishops have spoken strongly and explicitly on a number of issues, particularly the escalating nuclear arms race. A thorough review of Catholic teaching on war and peace would require an assessment of biblical and sophistic literature, as well as significant contributions from every major era of Catholic theology. Especially relevant for our work, however, is the papal and conciliar teaching of the nuclear age, reaching from Pope Pius XII through Pope John Paul II. The pastoral constitution on the Church in the modern world of the Second Vatican Council has a unique status among recent statements, since it has set the theological framework for Catholic thinking about contemporary warfare. The conciliar text called the Church to undertake an evaluation of warfare with an entirely new attitude, and it provided an example of what that attitude should be. The pastoral constitution made four principal contributions to the moral debate about war and peace. First, in its assessment of scientific weapons of mass destruction, of which nuclear weapons are the principal example, it uttered a clear condemnation. It condemned attacks on civilian centers or large populated areas as a crime against God and humanity. Second, it supported the right of conscientious objection, a pacifist position, in the clearest statement we have yet in Catholic teaching. Third, it reasserted the right of nations to acts of legitimate defense, an acknowledgement that some uses of force under restricted conditions could be justified. Fourth, it raised, but did not resolve, the moral issues posed by the doctrine of nuclear deterrence. I have said that the pastoral constitution has set the framework of Catholic thinking on war in the past 15 years. This is not due to an absence of other statements since 1965, but rather to the fact that these other statements reflect the elements of the conciliar teaching. Primary among them have been the Day of Peace messages of Pope Paul VI and Pope John Paul II, the powerful statement of the Holy See to the United Nations in 1976, and the address of Pope John Paul II at the United Nations in 1979. The theological and pastoral consequences of the pastoral constitution have not produced one single viewpoint in the Church, but have resulted in a series of related positions. We have seen the emergence of a significant school of Catholic pacifism, now supported by an authentic statement of Catholic teaching. We have seen others use the traditional moral category of non-competent immunity, just cause, and proportionality to enter the Vietnam debate as well as the debate on U.S. nuclear policy. Most recently, the unfinished agenda of the conciliar text, a judgment on the possession of nuclear weapons for deterrent purposes, has become a central issue for many groups in the church, both in the United States and in Europe. While these developments have been generating in the wider ecclesial community, our Episcopal Conference has taken a series of positions from 1968 to 1980. The principal texts have been the pastoral letters, Human Life in Our Day, 1968, and To Live in Christ Jesus, 1976, along with Cardinal Kroll's testimony on the SALT II Treaty before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, 1979, and the Administrative Board's Statement on Registration and the Draft, 1980. Our statements have reflected the wider debate in the church, but they have also contributed to it on key issues. We have spoken to some issues with more specificity than any other Episcopal conference. In Human Life in Our Day, and then in subsequent statements in 1972 and 1980, we acknowledge the continuing legitimacy of service in the military as a service to society. But we also endorse the right of conscientious objection, a pacifist position, and selective conscientious objection, a conclusion that can be drawn from traditional just war theory. These three categories have particular pastoral relevance, since they are designed to aid an individual faced with either voluntary or compulsory military service. In To Live in Christ Jesus, we made our first explicit judgment on the possession of nuclear weapons, arguing that not only the use, but the threat to use them against civilian centers is wrong. Cardinal Kroll's 1979 testimony rendered a more extended evaluation of the nuclear question. It made three interrelated moral judgments. First, the primary moral imperative is to prevent any use of nuclear weapons under any conditions. Second, the testimony judged that the possession of nuclear weapons in our policy of deterrence cannot be justified in principle, but can be tolerated only if the deterrent framework is used to make progress on arms limitation and reduction. The third principle, a corollary of the second, is the imperative for the superpowers to pursue meaningful arms limitations aimed at substantial reductions and real disarmament. Indeed, as Cardinal Kroll stated, the phasing out altogether of nuclear deterrence and the threat of mutual assured destruction must always be the goal of our efforts. This body of moral teaching, along with the theological commentary it has stimulated, provides us with some firm principles, and it leaves us with some open questions. The Second Vatican Council's teaching on the responsibility of personal conscience on the issue of warfare has already had an effect in the life of the church, and calls us to provide for effective methods of conscience formation on the issues of war and peace. The Council opened the deterrence question and left it for precisely the kind of debate we now see in the Church. Cardinal Kroll's testimony has led many to ask if the failure to move toward meaningful arms limitation in the last 2 years will yield a new judgment on deterrence policy from the bishop. Our statement on the draft in 1980 called for further elaboration if the possibility of the draft moves closer. It is precisely these questions and others too numerous to mention which faced the committee. The escalating pace of the arms race intensifies the moral urgency to address such issues. Let me share with you now some thoughts on major areas of concern which surely will be the subject of our deliberations. My purpose in this concluding section is to provide some issues which illustrate, but are not meant to exhaust, the scope of the committee's concern. The first question is the need for a positive theology of peace. Much of the traditional moral literature has been aimed at limiting the destructiveness of war. Such moral teaching has been and will continue to be needed. The thrust of the pastoral constitution of the Second Vatican Council and the major papal texts of the last 20 years, however, call for a more comprehensive and constructive approach to the question of war and peace. We are summoned to a positive theology of peace. This is surely implied in the Council's mandate to evaluate war with an entirely new attitude. We must find ways to call the Christian community to be a sign and source of peace in our society. In developing a theology of peace, we will need to draw upon many resources. The contribution of pacifist thought has not been a central theme in Catholic theology for many centuries. One should not simply equate a theology of peace with a pacifist position, but we will need to probe the nonviolent philosophy and position in our deliberations. Second, the stringent limits placed on the use of force in the modern age by the popes from Pius XII to John Paul II need to be affirmed and their implications examined today. In evaluating which, if any, reasons can justify the use of force in the modern age, we will be shadowed by the nuclear threat at every step. But our experience with the moral turmoil provoked by Vietnam highlights the need for an assessment of non-nuclear uses of force. Periodically, in the last decade, the threat of an oil boycott has produced proposals that the United States be prepared to fight a conventional war over oil. Some of these proposals seem to take it for granted that the justification to do this for oil and other resources is self-evident. In an age of interdependence, when access to resources is ever before us, and when developing countries have a new determination to exercise their sovereign rights over resources in their territories, the traditional categories of just cause, right intention, and proper authority to initiate the use of force may take on renewed importance as tools to assess policy proposals and intentions in our society. Sharpening the just cause question may give us a valuable instrument to evaluate a self-proclaimed right to access to resources even at the price of war. While both a theology of peace and an examination of conventional war are difficult issues, It probably will be the moral problem of nuclear war which will present the committee its most challenging task. This is so for a number of reasons. First, the United States first developed atomic and hydrogen weapons and used atomic weapons with consequences so frightful that Pope Paul VI and Pope John Paul II have both said it can never be allowed to happen again. Both as Catholics and as Americans, we hold a special responsibility to see that this first nuclear use is also the last. Second, the United States is among the countries which have concentrated on the development of nuclear weapons of greater accuracy. Increasingly, we have built our national security around these weapons. Third, in recent years, the nuclear strategy of the United States has supplemented our reliance on deterrence with a greater declaratory willingness to fight limited nuclear wars, although much expert opinion seriously doubts that the limits can be maintained. Fourth, as I have indicated, the position taken by the American bishops raises challenging questions about U.S. policy. The failure, after so many years of effective arms limitation, the growing official readiness to contemplate the use of nuclear weapons, and the introduction of highly integrated command and control systems, which may heighten the thrust toward automatic use of our weapons if deterrence fails, all make the need to evaluate existing policy more evident. How we make that evaluation competently and credibly is perhaps the most difficult assignment before the committee. It's important to note that the hierarchies of Holland, Germany, and England, in response to many in their care, are conducting inquiries into these issues of nuclear policy. It will be highly desirable that we maintain contact with them throughout our study. It is also important to note that in undertaking this project, we are fully aware that current tensions are by no means attributable to U.S. policy alone. Clearly, the enormous buildup of nuclear and conventional arms pursued by the Soviet Union in recent years has done more than its share to heighten the peril of the present moment. The duty of responsible moral action falls equally on both superpowers. But if we direct our attention particularly to the United States, it is for the simple reason that we are American citizens and have a right and duty to address our government. The purpose of all our efforts in this study is to fulfill our role as teachers regarding a question that has enormous significance for human life in our time. It will be our objective to speak first to the church. In this regard, our goal must be not only to state the teaching of the church on nuclear warfare clearly, but to find ways and means to bring this teaching to our parishes, pulpits, and schools. As teachers, we must also be concerned about the quality of public debate. The church should bring to this debate the best arguments which reason can muster. But beyond this, we should bring convictions that help us to keep a correct perspective in the face of such an awesome question as nuclear war. We need to be convinced that some actions can never be taken, even for survival, that there are limits to the argument that because our adversaries are considering something, we must be prepared to do it also. We need to recall that as Americans, And as people of faith, we are expected to have our own principles, to be prepared to live by them, and in faith, to accept the consequences of doing so. In the end, our study, though political and moral in content, is an expression of our ecclesial responsibility. By living in one of the nuclear superpowers, we are called to a specific form of witness. The very created order is threatened by nuclear war. We who believe that we are stewards of life and creation, not its masters, must use all the religious and moral vision we have to prevent a threat to what God has created, what we could destroy but never recreate. The significance of our task must be judged by our awareness of this responsibility. We must learn how to evaluate war with an entirely new attitude. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Archbishop Bernardin. We're deeply grateful to you and to your committee. Bishop Michael Kenny.
Archbishop Bernardin and my fellow bishops, I want to express my wholehearted support with the work of your committee, and I appreciate and I think after hearing you, I sympathize with the complexity and the urgency of your task. Permit me for a moment to share with you a concern which I think you, Archbishop Bernardin, expressed in the concluding portion of your presentation. In our teaching as Catholic bishops about the issue of war and peace, I believe it is critically important that we distance ourselves to a degree from time and place, that is, from this particular age and this particular nation. It is crucial for us to step back and take a global, long-range point of view. And I say this for two reasons. First of all, as you so eloquently pointed out, since the advent of nuclear weapons, what is at stake is no longer this or that form of government, this or that philosophy of life, but the continued existence of all life, especially human life. Secondly, when we as a church ally ourselves too closely with a particular country or age, we tend to weaken our prophetic role. In some notable instances in our past, such alliance has gotten us into serious trouble. As followers of Christ, whose naked image on the cross hangs before us, our kingdom is not of this world. Because we are a faith community, support from one government will not be all that much good to us, and opposition and oppression from another government will not destroy us. What I am saying is that as church, we should not be overly concerned even about our own safety and security. We are His church. And we have His promise that the gates of hell will not prevail against us. Our primary concern, therefore, should be always proclaiming the gospel with courage and conviction. Our concern should be for the life and well-being of all our brothers and sisters, whoever and wherever they may be. Thank you, Bishop.
Bishop O'Rourke.
Thank you. Thank you, Archbishop Roach. Archbishop Bernardin, your speech is probably not specific about the resolution of the terrible dilemma with which we are confronted. Yet I recall that several of our fellow bishops have declared publicly that all use or threat to use nuclear arms is immoral. Some have urged unilateral disarmament by the United States. Indeed, some of our brother bishops have expressed the opinion that we are approaching a consensus, at least regarding the first of these two views. Lest we be stampeded toward that opinion, I rise to state that many of us bishops have grave reservations about both of those declarations. I wish briefly to outline some of the reasons for those reservations. Let me preface these remarks by affirming that all of us wish to curb and to reverse the arms race, that every rational person wants to avoid a nuclear holocaust. There is a danger, however, that our efforts to curb the arms race may actually cause its continuing, and that our protestations of the immorality of nuclear warfare may trigger it. For example, if this body were to call for unilateral disarmament, is it not likely that the Soviets would refuse to engage in any serious SALT negotiation in the hope that they might receive a windfall, a tremendous almost certainly our unilateral disarmament would lead to a great expansion of communist domination in the world. This would represent the greatest step backward in the pursuit of justice and peace in the history of mankind. Someone may respond, declaring that the use or threat to use nuclear arms is absolutely immoral. Hence, we must condemn both, regardless of the consequences. I question the assumption that we are dealing here with a moral absolute. Actually, we are at present involved in a very complex moral principle, that of a just war, in concrete circumstances which are even more complex. We might appropriately express our views with humility and great reservation. Recently, at Bonn, Germany, during the massive demonstration against nuclear arms, a small plane flew over the area, pulling a sign which read, "Who is marching in Moscow?" Obviously, a similar free expression of opinion is not permitted in Moscow. We who enjoy freedom of speech have a corresponding obligation to speak judiciously, particularly in a matter so complex and so volatile as the issue of peace and war. Therefore, Archbishop Bernardin, I urge you and your committee to adhere steadfastly to your decision, to examine this issue with highly professional thoroughness before presenting the suggested resolution of the problems we are addressing. Thank you, Bishop.
Bishop Walter Sullivan.
I rise to support Archbishop Bernardin and his committee. I think it is certainly an excellent beginning, and we look forward to sharing in the discussion. I do hope that bishops will have the opportunity during this year between now and next November to have an opportunity to maybe even publicly and personally express their interests and their positions. The thing that comes to my mind, of course, is the urgency of the situation which the Archbishop had talked about. We have had now, or will have, 2 years, not of a vacuum, but we see in our own country the growing increase of the arms race. I think just during this week, there was a vote in Congress for the MX missile and the B-1 bomber. In other words, the spiral continues in a madness of a circle. And I think it's important that during this interim period that we have the courage to stand up for our convictions. We talked, and Archbishop Bernardine mentioned so beautifully about the danger of phrases like limited nuclear war. And our Holy Father has warned very, very strongly of the danger of accident. We have no idea what will be triggered throughout the world, that we are 5 minutes away from a nuclear holocaust, and that to me is the starting point of when we start thinking of moral dimensions. What possibly can we do during this interim period? I would like to encourage bishops, maybe this is a blessing, the interim, that bishops on the local level in their dioceses are speaking out. We talk about being teachers and educators. I hope that every bishop here will be that teacher and educator on the theology of peace. Secondly, I would hope that we would support the people who are in our diocese working for peace. There is a growing movement, people very, very concerned, to sit down and to dialogue with them. And the final thing that I would like to encourage, because I agree with Bishop O'Rourke, I'm really not sure who in this body is for doing away with every type of defense. I always almost think that that's a straw man that comes to make the position look foolish. I would like to see if people are very supportive of what Bishop O'Rourke is saying, that perhaps we as a body on the local level might support the nuclear freeze, that this is a growing movement to ask our country and the Soviet Union. This is a bilateral freeze. It's not a unilateral freeze. And we're talking about a moratorium as the first step, a moratorium on testing, the production, and the deployment of nuclear weapons. Would that the superpowers, as the first step to put a halt to the production of these weapons. And it would be my hope then after that, there would be a mutual way for the reducing of the nuclear armament. And so I would hope that during this interim period, because of the urgency, that we continue to be not only prophetic, but the teachers in our own communities on peacemaking. Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop. Bishop Stafford.
Thank you. Thank you, Archbishop. I have 2 points to make. One is the reference to the 800th anniversary of the celebration of the birth of St. Francis of Assisi, which commemoration will be extending for 2 years. And I would recommend to the committee that they reflect and perhaps reflect upon and show in their document the experience of Francis, especially in the Crusade of 1219. The crucifix that we have before us is a replica of the crucifix in San Damiano, in which Francis was urged to rebuild the church. And I would hope that we would be using the example of Francis in this response to the challenge of our own time. The second point I wish to make is this, Archbishop. In our pursuit of peace, it is important that we keep in mind the truth in this dictum that war is the continuation of policy by other means. That is, war is not fundamentally another grosser expression of human irrationality or of base human motivations, although it is surely both of these. Rather, there is an instrumental character to war and the threat of war that has to be acknowledged by any of us who are serious about the peace effort. War does a specific job. It settles the argument over who rules. Our target is institutional violence, and I underline institutionalized, the mass organized violence of war rationalized as an absolute necessity of state or revolutionary ideology. A world in which everyone is fed, clothed, housed, educated, and medically cared for would not be a world without war, and this is the key point, unless alternative means of settling political conflict were in place and enforced. And this is the main part of what I would hope that the committee would keep in mind. Pope John the 23rd recognized this in Pacem in Terris, a document largely ignored. A world without war, envisioned by Pope John, would be a disarmed world under law, where there was a sufficient minimum of political community to sustain that law, and which the political and economic development problems of the third world were being addressed and solved. The key to Pope John's vision was the idea of law and political community on a worldwide basis. The Pope saw that the problem of war had been solved in many areas of the world, especially those areas known as nation states. The necessary next step, according to the Pope, was to transfer that learning to the international level. I favor a thorough study of Pacem in Terris, in which our national concern should be focused on strengthening international law, international human rights, and third world development. With regard to disarmament, a recent article in the London Tablet endorses an alternative to unilateral disarmament, what is called a strategy of independent peace initiatives. And I would like very briefly to quote that and also to recommend that to the committee. This centers on independent de-escalatory acts which do not jeopardize security in the conventional sense, but invite reciprocal acts on the part of a potential adversary and hold some promise of creating a momentum of disarmament. The difference between this and the unilateralist theory is that it appeals not to the adversary's conscience, but to his self-interest. Thank you.
Thank you. Could I merely indicate that I would like to, this discussion can't terminate, obviously, and I would like it to go on, and it will. But we will have to terminate by 3:30, which gives us a half an hour, which will put us 35 minutes over the scheduled time. 12 people have asked to speak. Just the roughest mathematics will tell you that, in fairness to the 12th, if somebody talks longer than 3 minutes or 2.5, we've got a problem. So if you might just keep that in mind. Archbishop Garrity.
Well, I too would like to compliment the committee and Archbishop Bernardin on the direction that they're taking. I think a number of the things that I was going to say have already been said, and so I'll cede that part of the time. But I would like to second what Bishop Sullivan has said about the necessity on the local level of making statements and remembering that we are in an interim period when this nuclear cloud hanging over us is extremely dangerous. And it seems to me that we have a duty not only as a conference and as American citizens, but also as local bishops, not to lose heart. We do have the possibility in this country of influencing our government. We have already had evidence of that, I think, this morning when the president has, in giving in to public opinion, apparently, has expressed his willingness, as I understand, to go into negotiations. I just urge that none of us lose heart. We must realize that we do have a chance, and we've got to form a constituency for peace. Speak up.
Bishop Walsh.
Archbishop Bernardin and committee and my brother bishops,
I'm very pleased with the biblical, theological, and historical foundation upon which this report and statement are based. With regard to other excellent statements made by members of this conference in recent months, I've truly regretted the almost universal neglect of this same foundation by those who have grasped at what were considered unusual, headline-making, and even immoral invitations to reflect prayerfully on options open to the voting citizenry. I've been disappointed and dismayed by the fact that the faith dimension of many of the fine statements made has not been widely publicized. It should be our firm intention to insist that this statement of Archbishop Bernardine and his committee be studied in toto, and that its foundation receive at least as much and hopefully more attention as the other aspects which might appear to be more newsworthy. Thank you.
Thank you. Bishop Mathiasen.
Archbishop, I would like to commend the committee for the work that it has begun, and to urge that committee and this body of bishops to concentrate on our role. We are not military strategists. We are not political strategists. We are Catholic bishops dedicated to following the Prince of Peace, who nowhere ever said that that peace would be achieved by violence, but rather said, put up your sword, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. I believe that as bishops, we must keep that faith dimension before our people, and I would urge this committee not to get so involved in all kinds of theories as to forget what we began with in the very beginning. Secondly, I would like to see this committee address the very real plight of the workers who are currently involved in the development of these nuclear weapons. As the level of our awareness of the unequivocal condemnation of these weapons by our Holy Father, all the way from Pius XII, to the Vatican statement of Vatican II, to the Vatican statement at the disarmament conferences that have been held. As that level of awareness grows in the minds of our people, the level of their anxiety is also growing, and I can personally attest to that. That's how I began my own involvement in this debate. We bishops must not only condemn this nuclear madness, but we must also aggressively pursue the works of justice. We must urge the conversion of these nuclear plants that produce these horrible weapons of destruction to the production of food, clothing, shelter, medicine, transportation, and the tools of the arts and the sciences. Much more than the munitions industry will ever be able to do, such peaceful pursuits will provide jobs and will allow us to throw off the fear, the very real fear, under which we are now forced to live. I'm afraid that we may get ourselves back into discussing this in some kind of an ivory tower where we discuss theological principles and our theological past and forget that we're dealing with a horrible issue that is present. We must protest the very real and present threat of annihilation without representation. Thank you.
Bishop Nicholas.
Thank you, Archbishop. It's unnecessary to add my public support for Archbishop Bernardine's splendid committee. I've told him privately of the makeup of the committee. I think he's off to a great start. I would simply say, as the previous speaker said, that we cannot operate in an ivory tower. And I guess, Archbishop Bernardine, one thing that I would bring to your attention is that in the latter part of your talk, you spoke of the tremendous buildup in the Soviet Union, which we, of course, are not in a position to address as we are our own country's situation, our own government situation. But last year, almost unanimously, with perhaps two or three dissenting votes, this body adopted a paper entitled Marxism and Communism, in which we looked at the worldwide threat of communism. I served as chairman of that committee by your appointment. During your administration as president, I was privileged as the chairman of the Social Development to issue with our committee a paper entitled Human Rights in Eastern Europe. And as you look at papal pronouncements and as you look at our own pronouncements, I would make a very strong plea that you keep in mind those times that we as bishops, certainly as Pope John Paul II and Pope Paul VI, have eloquently spoken against the threat of communism. I applaud the fact that you include the Soviet Union, but I think the public record shows that there have been few uses of force in the last 20 years that have not directly involved the threat of worldwide communism. And I would suggest respectfully, and as a friend and admirer of the work of the committee, that the subject of war and peace, drawing heavily upon statements, papal and our own, against the dangers of nuclear warfare, not be isolated from those instances when we have spoken of the terrible effects of power and force, as we see in Eastern Europe, parts of Latin America, and as we see represented not just by the Soviet Union, but by the broad base of worldwide communism.
Archbishop Hannon.
Thank you very much, Justice. For the record, I'd like to say that I abhor war together with the members of the committee, and also view with great dismay the use of nuclear weapons. However, to me, the basic question in this, and which has not been addressed at all, and I wish it could be included actually in the wording of the topic, is the question of freedom under God. War is unintelligible without a consideration of freedom under God and the dignity of man and human rights. Also, it seems to me that there's no reason why we should not have a military expert among the advisors. Whenever we deal with any other question, we deal with the experts in that field. And with due deference to His Eminence Cardinal Kroll, all of the military men that I know understand MAD as being mutually assured deterrence or defense, not destruction. The Holy Father, when he journeyed to Poland, he went there to secure freedom. That's the real crux of the matter today. I'd like also to, and by the way, I will write this to the committee. I'm only going to outline some of the subjects that I'll treat on. The weapons of sufficient effectiveness have always been a deterrent. And by the way, we ourselves, in the statement of 1968, we said this, the council, and they're referring there especially to Gaudamit Spes, the council did not call for unilateral disarmament. Christian morality is not lacking in realism, but it did call for reciprocal or collective disarmament, proceeding at an equal pace according to agreement and backed up by authentic and workable safeguards. That is a direct statement from Gaudium et Spes. I also would like to point out that nuclear weapons are a varied strength. This talk about there being an assured destruction of millions of people, contrary to fact. For instance, Thomas E. Murray, a very devout Catholic, when he was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, he was the one that forwarded the development of nuclear weapons of comparatively low yield. And the very fact that you can fire those weapons by artillery shows that they are of very limited yield, very small scope of destruction. The governments in Western Europe, especially Mitterrand, a socialist, have recognized that they must have a nuclear deterrent for their own defense. And let me say that a deterrent has always worked. For instance, in World War I, there was poisonous gas. Unfortunately, I lost a cousin killed by poisonous gas. But just as soon as we developed a deterrent, then there is no longer the use of the of poisonous gas, except by the Soviet Union in those countries which do not have a deterrent of poisonous gas. That is, in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and in Afghanistan. I'd like also, in closing, simply to say that Pius XII stated even in 1948 and also in 1953, and by the way, Bishop Stafford followed closely his statements in that regard, Pius XII stated that a nation has a duty to defend itself, and this at a time when nuclear weapons existed. He said in 53 again, this right for self-defense cannot be denied even in these days to any state. And Gaudium et Spes said exactly the same thing. Pius VI, Paul VI, said exactly the same thing in regard to peace. And to me, it's still good theology that we have in the Declaration of Independence that our Creator did mean us to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thank you.
Bishop Rosazzi, I say. Bishop Rosazzi.
Archbishop, I commend also the thrust that the committee is taking at this time. One word of input, to see the United States as the largest, as far as I know, a supplier of arms in the world to even Latin American dictatorships, which does cut down the freedom of those who are living in situations of injustice and would like to overthrow that yoke. A second point to be helpful to your committee, I would propose that since we are involved in a demonic situation, the whole arms race throughout the world, that our conference takes upon itself, all the members, the responsibility of prayer and fasting one day a week for peace. The bishops of the Anglican Church have already done this, and I commend it to our body. And I just end up by saying, listening to this debate, I am extremely proud to be a member of this body. Thank you.
Archbishop Quinn.
Archbishop and my brother bishops, I strongly support the work of this committee, but I would hope that when we speak about avoiding an ivory tower, that we don't consider doing something merely of a purely pragmatic nature and forget the Catholic moral tradition and teaching of the Church and try to root everything that we do in that theological and moral teaching. This moment that we now confront in regard to the nuclear weapons is an extremely grave moment in the history of this question. And I think it would be wrong if we think only in terms of the Soviet Union as one of the problems created in this area. Within a few years' time, 4 or 5 years' time, if I am not mistaken, there will be 46 nations in all that will possess these nuclear weapons. And so the problem is spreading like some kind of lethal epidemic over the world. The question of deterrence, until very recently, until the last year or two, has been founded in the psychological assumption that these weapons were of such a terrible destructive nature that no one would ever use them, that those who had them knew that they were so terrible that they would never be used. But that psychological barrier, or what has been called a psychological firebreak, is now being eroded by the talk of exploding these weapons as a demonstration, or the talk of limited nuclear exchange. And so we are truly in a qualitatively new situation or problematic, which is a very, very grave and dangerous thing for us. The President today. I have not seen his words, but have heard only in general that he has taken a step forward in calling for a strong movement in the direction of a freeze or disarmament. This change in attitude has been brought about through a formed public opinion. And I think it's very important to recognize that this public opinion now is not coming from one single segment of society. It is coming from all segments of society. There is something stirring very deeply in the soul of humanity about this issue. And it is coming from scientists, medical doctors, the medical profession, from young and old, from the educated and the uneducated, and from all strata of society in all parts of the world. So I think we have a very grave obligation to encourage and sustain that public opinion at this moment when there has been some indication of movement forward.
It's like
a commercial and a comment. Last year around this time, I advertised Pax Christi as a fine resource for peace, thought, and action for the Episcopal Conference, and we got 25 additional bishops after that advertisement, so I'm beginning to think of myself as a salesman, particularly since we are going to study this question in a more in-depth way. I would recommend again to the bishops that they become a member of Pax Christi. Secondly, Archbishop Bernardin, I would like to recommend strongly to your committee that you take up in a very specific way our traditional just war theory. When St. Augustine promulgated that theory centuries ago, I believe his intention was to make war impossible in order that the Christian people might live in consonance with the gospel. I think we need to restudy that theory for the same intention. And finally, as a Franciscan, I certainly want to endorse what Bishop Stafford said.
Bishop McFarland.
Lest there be any misunderstanding by those who are not bishops present, the support of Bishop Bernardin's work as committee is unanimous among the bishops. To say otherwise would be to say that this question isn't relevant and that we don't address it. The work is just beginning, and what practical conclusions will be arrived at and presented to the bishops and then debated and in a final pastoral be published may have a unanimous or not so unanimous agreement. What I would ask the committee to do, and hopefully that we ourselves as the body in addressing this question, above all, if we're going to be any help at all in this question, is to be logical, to be consistent, and of course to be honest. And that means to follow the moral imperative to its ultimate conclusions and not try to soften it in any way. If the conclusions come
Archbishop Bernardin, I would have come to the church. I have one great practical suggestion to support your words about effective and sensitive communication of this message after it has been completed. I would suggest to my brother bishops the possibility of sending to our priests the very valuable framework that you have given to us today, as well as the Archbishop Broach's presidential address yesterday as a preparation, as a preview of coming attractions. Thank you.
Bishop Meeting says. I certainly do not believe that we could have a more important challenge than to come up with an intelligent, practical study of not just war and peace, but I recall the words of Pope Paul VI. He says, if you want peace, promote justice. Therefore, I would like to suggest that in this document, in this study, we really treat the root cause for all evil, injustice, lack of righteousness. And I think we have a lot of material that we can draw on for that. I do think that one of the things that Pope John Paul II said, that he wanted his time as Pope to be a priority on ecumenism. That was one of his priorities. And I think it's very encouraging that we have the national bodies of the Presbyterian Church that I know of, and I quoted in my statement, and also the House of Episcopal Bishops. They have made some splendid statements, I think, on this. The next thing, I think, is that we need, as I did and I call for in my statement, all the religious houses especially to devote Friday as a day of abstinence or fast and prayer. I think this is one of the things that we can do perhaps in our general intercession. If this is very important, then it deserves all of our prayer to fulfill the first statement of the Lord's public ministry, repent and believe the gospel.
Bishop Mark Hurley.
I realize the time is late, and like Henry VIII, as he said to his wife, I will not keep you long. I would like to point out in the question of the theology of peace that over the years, as we have taken a position on the right to life, we have been dubbed by our dear friends in the press and media as being right-wing. And I am sure as a result of what they're hearing here today, we will be dubbed as left-wing. And I would like to emphasize that we see ourselves as thoroughly consistent in defending the right to life in both instances, as we say, from the womb to the tomb. And I think that is a fundamental base on which we are proceeding. I would like also to say that I believe that we bishops agree on most things in reference to this debate. I mean, even in some of the specifics. We all agree that the arms race is insane. $500 billion this year on armaments alone, and then we say we can't feed the world. This gets to the question of justice and pulling those together. Also, I'd like to mention that it isn't just nuclear arms in reference to the poor, it's also conventional arms, and the poor nations are arming themselves. And I think that will figure in the equation. I think we all believe in the right of self-defense. But the basic theology on the right to life, one more item, I'm finished, and that is that in our theology, we say that we were talking about the right to life and also the question of atomic annihilation. We do not affirm that life is an absolute. Now, this cuts both ways. It can cut one way in saying, because we believe in a resurrection, it really doesn't matter too much whether we are annihilated in the long run by atomic bombs or by cancer. That's one way. The other way it cuts, however, is that there are people who will believe and who will affirm that freedom is greater even than life itself, and therefore we are willing to fight and die for our country. So I see that as kind of a base on which we can at least raise the question to the committee for their expertise in solving it. Thank you very much.
Well, you are not only visionaries and good theologians, but you're good mathematicians. We're right at 3:30, and the 12 has been heard from. Archbishop Bernadin, once again, we're extremely grateful to you, and very grateful to all of you, those of you who have spoken to this issue, and those of you who pray about it and who work for peace. So we're grateful to you. Thank you very much. We have a ballot.
These are the results of the first ballot for the third delegate going to the Synod. 229 members voted, and 115 would be needed to elect, and no one was chosen. On this ballot, the following results took place. Archbishop Casey, 1. Bishop Darcy, 41. Archbishop Flores, 50. Archbishop Hickey, 4. Archbishop Hunthausen, 2. Cardinal Kroll, 21. Bishop Lessard, 3. Bishop McFarland, 3. Bishop Malone, 15. Archbishop May, 1.